The feeling was surreal, I would say, because at that time I know that this may be the last time that I could step on the soil of Hong Kong.
Some Hong Kong residents make a big move. It's Tuesday, March 16th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Find us online. We're at VOA Asia Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. Also ahead, South Korea considers universal income, arbitrary killings in the Philippines, a COVID urban exodus, rosy goodbyes, Bali boosts compost. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Britain is preparing for tens of thousands of Hong Kong citizens to apply for special visas to settle in the UK after the government launched a new scheme that offers fast-track citizenship to residents of the former British colony in response to China's crackdown on basic freedoms. Beijing has strongly criticized the move. VOA's Henry Ridgewell spoke to one pro-democracy activist in London who was forced to flee Hong Kong and is now applying to settle in Britain.
Finn Lau is building a new life in Britain, but he's still fighting for Hong Kong's freedom. As a student in 2014, he was a key player in the so-called umbrella pro-democracy protests. A new job took him to Britain in 2019, just before protests broke out again in Hong Kong against China's extradition bill. Lau watched as the protests grew into a wider pro-democracy movement.
I did go back to Hong Kong in late December 2019 because I want to participate, I want to witness the street, the protests in Hong Kong. But then I was unfortunate to be arrested along with a few hundred others on the first day of 2020.
Lau was lucky. The police failed to identify him as a protest ringleader and he was released.
So I just immediately fly back to the UK 1 or 2 days later after the arrest. And on the plane, the feeling was surreal, I would say. Because at that time, I know that this may be the last time that I could step on the soil of Hong Kong.
A few months after arriving safely back in Britain, Lau was attacked on the street.
Back in April 2020, there was a rumour that there has been a £10,000 bounty on my life, on my head. And then 2 months later, when I was walking in a normally safe neighbourhood, I was suddenly ambushed or attacked by unknown street gangs. They didn't take away any of my personal belongings. They didn't say a word.
British police failed to identify his assailants. In June, Beijing imposed a national security law on Hong Kong. Britain says the crackdown breaches the handover agreement signed in 1997, which China denies. In response, Britain recently launched a new visa scheme for Hong Kong residents holding British Nationals Overseas or BNO passports, which were offered before Britain's handover of the territory. The visas offer the ability to work and study and fast-tracked British citizenship. Lau has just submitted his application.
Some people may think that a BNO scheme is not a direct tool that could leverage against the CCP. Because the CCP won't be hurt by the BNO scheme. But on the other hand, some people may think that this offers a kind of lifeboat to Hong Kongers.
While grateful, Lau and other Hong Kong exiles want Britain to do more.
We just think that maybe some more actions could be carried out by the UK government. For example, maybe some sort of Magnitsky-style sanction, which could the assets of some Hong Kong government officials like Carrie Lam could be freezed by the UK government.
Britain says it is considering such sanctions. Meanwhile, Lau and other exiles continue fighting for Hong Kong's freedom, helped by the lifeline offered by a British BNO visa. But even on the streets of London, Lau says he does not feel safe from the long arm of China's Communist Party. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
In Myanmar, authorities have extended martial law in more areas of the main city of Yangon Monday amid reports of more killings of protesters at the hands of security forces. State-run MRTV News Channel announced four districts are under martial law a day after security forces killed at least 40 people across Myanmar. It was the bloodiest day of demonstrations against the junta that seized power in a February 1st coup. Authorities imposed martial law after several Chinese-owned factories were set on fire, and about 2,000 people had apparently stopped fire engines from reaching them. China is seen as supportive of the Myanmar junta. A Chinese foreign ministry spokesman said the burning and looting of Chinese companies is abhorrent. We invite you to read more by following our Twitter stream at VOA Asia, also on Facebook, and at our website, voanews.com. These are among some of the top Asia headlines you'll find right now when you visit voanews.com. Myanmar junta extends martial law in Yangon after dozens of anti-coup protesters killed. Top U.S. officials in Asia on first overseas visit. Bangladesh says investigation opened after accusations of torture against cartoonist. Massive sandstorm shrouds China's capital. Australia plans to restart international travel using a COVID-19 bubble with Singapore. Expanded coverage of these stories and much more are on Facebook at VOA Asia and the voanews.com website. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We continue with VOA Asia. The idea of universal basic income, where every citizen receives a regular amount of money from the government, has long been considered a fringe or radical idea in South Korea. The coronavirus pandemic may be changing that, as VOA's Bill Gallo reports from Seoul.
Lee Gon-hyung epitomizes a major problem with South Korea's economy. There just aren't enough jobs for young people. Nearly 30% of youth like Yi are unemployed or underemployed.
There was only part-time work in this job market, and my job just didn't provide enough income, and at a certain age, no one wants to ask your parents for help.
Yi didn't have to. He was one of tens of thousands of Koreans to get regular checks from the government simply because he was 24 years old. It's part of a bold economic project in this province just outside Seoul, which is increasingly handing out cash to its citizens. In addition to checks for 24-year-olds, the province is also giving out cash pandemic relief to everyone. The money must be spent at local businesses like this market, or it will expire, a policy many business owners like.
The relief funds have been a huge help to our market. We have people coming here who ordinarily never shop at a local market.
The project is spearheaded by Governor Lee Jae-myung. He believes eventually all Koreans should receive universal basic income, or UBI.
It'll help consumption, lead to more demand, more employment, and more investment. And anyway, it's a future we can't avoid due to the fourth industrial revolution.
South Korea, one of the world's most technologically advanced societies, is at the forefront of that revolution. Cell phones and other technology long ago reshaped or even eliminated many human interactions. The pandemic has sped up that trend, creating a contact-free or untacked environment, as it's called in Korea.
Until now, UBI was just a theory in the textbooks. But with the pandemic, we've seen the digital, untacked environment it created and how labor isn't needed as much to produce things. I think the idea is gaining momentum.
So much momentum that Lee is a front-runner to become president next year, though he has lots of critics.
What proponents of basic income overlook is that individuals need money and public services, and the state must provide those services. But they'll collapse if UBI is adopted.
The critics say UBI amounts to cheap populism, meant to win votes. They prefer more targeted welfare programs to help those in need. But direct cash payments are becoming a global trend. In the U.S., multiple stimulus checks have gone directly to bank accounts.
So I think there was already generally a direction toward accepting UBI in some form or another, but COVID perhaps accelerated it.
Whether that trend outlasts the pandemic is much less clear. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and Pentagon Chief Lloyd Austin are meeting with allies in Japan and South Korea this week to reaffirm the Trans-Pacific partnerships in the face of an increasingly assertive China and silent North Korea. Washington's top diplomatic and defense officials began their tour of the region with a stop in Tokyo, marking their first overseas travel as representatives of the Biden administration. Blinken and Austin are holding what's known as a 2+2, a meeting between foreign and defense chiefs with their Japanese counterparts today before they depart for Seoul on Wednesday. Happening now in Asia, China's worst sandstorm in a decade hit Beijing and northern parts of the country. Hundreds of flights were canceled because of low visibility and high winds. Authorities advise residents to stay indoors as air quality index report a hazardous rating. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad to have you with us today on VOA Asia. Thank you for listening. United Nations officials are condemning the arbitrary killing of 9 activists in 4 provinces in the Philippines earlier this week in what they say appears to have been coordinated, simultaneous police-military operations. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
This is not the first time such killings have taken place. On December 30th, 9 Tumandok indigenous people's rights activists were killed in Panay during similar joint operations. The UN Human Rights Office reports 8 men and 1 woman were killed in this latest joint police and military operation. Agency spokeswoman Ravina Shamdasani says the police obtained search warrants. They were presented as part of the government's counterinsurgency campaign against the New People's Army, the armed wing of the Communist Party of the Philippines. She says they entered the activists' homes in the dead of night and shot them.
So these search warrants were obtained in this context to conduct searches for weapons held as part of the communist insurgency. However, as you pointed out, these operations were carried out in the middle of the night, and those who were killed were working on issues such as the rights of fishing communities, indigenous people's rights, housing rights of people rendered homeless or people who have been evicted from urban slums.
Shamdasani calls the near total impunity for the use of lethal force by the police and the military shocking and says it must end.
We are deeply worried that these latest killings indicate an escalation in violence, intimidation and harassment and red tagging of human rights defenders. There is a history of human rights advocates being red tagged or being accused of being fronts for the armed wing of the Communist Party in the Philippines.
Human Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet warned in June of the dangers of such public labeling. She called for the protection of human rights defenders, journalists, and others at risk. However, Shamdasani says Bachelet's plea has not been heeded. She says dozens of activists and several journalists have been arrested, intimidated, and harassed since then. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
VOA Asia is on Twitter. Follow us at VOA Asia for developing stories in Asia, perhaps close to you. Our Twitter feed also has updates on programs you can hear and see with links to find them easily. With VOA Asia, you can also follow radio program host VOA Stevenson and VOA Melman. VOA Asia Twitter. We're always online for you.
Thank you. This news from VOA Asia. India reported its highest single-day spike in COVID-19 cases this year, more than 26,000 new cases reported in the last 24 hours. India has the third highest number of reported COVID-19 cases in the world at 11.36 million, according to Johns Hopkins University. You'll find this and more on VOA Asia Twitter and Facebook. This is VOA Asia. You're listening to VOA Asia. The latest data from American moving companies is showing that in the country's 30 most populated cities last year, more people left than arrived as the COVID-19 pandemic took hold. Keith Kaczynski reports from New York on one family who left the city for the countryside.
Ancrum, New York, is a small farming town of about 1,500 people, 2 hours north of New York City. It may not be the first place one would expect to find international supermodel Saskia de Brouw, Dutch photographer and filmmaker Vincent van den Vengard, and their four-year-old daughter Luna, but
life is pretty good here. I mean, there's space, you get great produce. So the quality of life is quite amazing.
It's not where they expected to be, and it's a stark contrast from their apartment in Brooklyn, New York.
It was a great life. We had everything well organized. My daughter went to school not too far away, and there were friends to see, and just a lovely neighborhood.
However, the coronavirus pandemic changed that.
We thought it would be all quickly a thing of the past, you know, the pandemic, and it wasn't.
As the infection spread through New York and the family was confined to their apartment, they looked beyond the city and bought this small home in this rural part of the state before they had even seen it in person.
We did notice a large body of New Yorkers take this opportunity to find solitude in another area where they had space, where they weren't on top of other people, so that they could at least protect themselves and their families.
At the same time, home prices in New York City dropped by 15% to 20% because of the pandemic, allowing people with lower income levels to move into some of the most affluent Manhattan neighborhoods.
Rents have come down in a way that actually has eased some of the affordability crisis.
The average salary in those high-end neighborhoods has dropped from $140,000 to $82,000 a year. And economists say the income of the new arrivals is around 40% less than those who are leaving the city. Yet, many expect residents will return to New York and other cities as the pandemic wanes, lured by the lower prices.
While the balance has shifted somewhat, to describe it as an urban exodus is clearly an exaggeration.
Real estate agents say the availability of COVID vaccines is already having an impact on the housing market.
I'm noticing people are ready to come back to New York. They are seeing this as an opportunity, those that are in the position, in the buyer's position, to find and grab a really good deal right now.
While Vincent and Saskia are not ready to give up living in the country, they are also feeling the pull of Brooklyn.
We also feel like the city has something really special to offer. And I think after 6 months being upstate, we kind of started missing it.
Keith Kosinski for VOA News, New York.
Making headlines in Asia, after a new surge in COVID-19 cases in Manila, Philippines has imposed a week-long curfew. This move comes as presidential spokesman Harry Roque, the country's leading voice on dealing with the pandemic, tested positive for COVID-19. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, social distancing has made gathering for funerals difficult, if not impossible. But a Los Angeles artist has created a way to remember every life lost during the pandemic. Angelina Bagsarian has this story, narrated by Anna Rice.
Petal after petal, thousands of felt red roses turn into a river. It's a creation by Los Angeles artist Marcus Lotians to honor the hundreds of thousands of people in the U.S. who have suffered loss due to the coronavirus.
You can feel the grief around you in the whole of the United States and in individuals too. And it might be because they lost a family member or a friend. But it may also be because they lost the opportunity as kids to be with their friends at school, or they've lost a job, or they've lost their home.
When Latin started working on his project, there were a lot fewer COVID victims. But as the numbers grew, so did his river of red felt roses. In Los Angeles County alone, over 18,500 people have died from the virus and related complications. Latience's art installation found its home at Hollywood Forever Cemetery.
Roses are used in cemeteries and funerals for the dead, and red roses symbolize valor and courage, and they're sometimes used, for instance, when soldiers return from war in caskets. They put on the casket. So that's why I chose the red rose as this kind of symbol.
People can join the project by helping to make the flowers.
They're made by hand, and the hand-making process is cathartic and healing, not just for, let's say, family members who've lost somebody to COVID, but also for, like, school kids who get to do something active and participate.
You have all the elements, all the materials, and the instructions to make the roses. After they make the roses, they can come back and bring the roses back. This is a very special moment for humanity, and this Marcos Lutyens project is fantastic because it's really bringing us together.
In the coming months, Lutyens, together with hundreds of volunteers, says he has plans to have 500,000 felt red roses. For Angelina Bogdasarian in Los Angeles, Anna Rice, VOA News.
A small village in Indonesia is sending less and less of their household waste to landfills. VOA's Rendy Wikesana reports on how they're making environmental waves.
Hi. Since 2012, the village of Parang Tegal in Bali, Indonesia, has instructed its residents to sort out their garbage before disposal. Wati does this every day.
Ini tempat sampah yang non-organik. Kalau yang ini, yang organik. Waktu saya lahir kan masih
when I was little, trees were everywhere. We used to burn our garbage, but no longer. Now we live in modern era. We are advised to sort out our garbage based on organic and non-organic category.
Non-organic.
Padang Tegal Village is situated at the heart of the popular tourist destination of Ubud. With only 607 families living there, the village may be small, but it produces a great amount of waste. So, local authorities built this 4,000 square meter compost house owned by the village.
The compost center only manages waste in Padang Tegal Village. Only families with their waste sorted out into organic and non-organic groups get collected. Then we process the organic waste into compost.
It's not the law everywhere, and it is a bit of a chore. Villagers not only spend time and energy sorting out their waste, but they also pay a $6 fee each month for garbage collection. So why do they participate? Well, simply because the village chief tells them to. My name is Ima Degandra, the chief of Parang Tegal Village. In Bali, Bendesa, or the village chief, is the highest rank leader in the village, elected democratically by its people. Whatever decided by the chief is a decision that the people must comply to. This is the eminence of our custom. Balinese generally reside in traditional villages, which have their very own regulations, known locally as Pararam and Awigawe. Whatever the village chief says is the law of the land. If they don't sort the waste out, their garbage won't be picked up. Local officials say that well over half of all the garbage the island produces is organic, so most of it can be composted. Practically, that means that every day this village transforms organic waste into 1 cubic meter of compost. The compost is then sold to local farmers and businesses. From Bali, Indonesia, Randy Wicaksana, VOA News.
That's all the time we have for today's program. We hope you join us again tomorrow at the same time for VOA Asia. In the meantime, follow us online. We're on Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, and Facebook. Look us up under our name, VOA Asia. We also thank those who help bring the program to you every day, our managing editor, Diane Gao, Ira Melman, Doug Bernard, Keith Lane, and Amy Hybels. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a super day ahead. Be safe. Be well.